Accession number 6395, reel 4.
Mr. Spears, reel 4.
In general, the American pattern bombing by definition, more widespread and less accurate than the RAF night bombing. It was in this context that several bombs landed on the camp in course of a raid against the V2 works at Brunswick in August 1944. And we were fortunate in that only two people were killed. But I think this was an inevitable hazard, really.
Two POWs?
Yes.
Were there any light assigned to life in the camps?
Yes, quite often, really, I suppose. They were usually directed against the occupying forces. I can remember in Italy when the Italians were being particularly hectoring, we were absolutely fascinated by the fact that the officer who was hectoring us on parade in a rayon silk shirt had his cigarette, his arms folded, and his cigarette was steadily burning a hole in his shirt, and we watched with fascination. David Sterling was in the Mary's Trubau camp and put his fingers up at the German officer as he passed, and the man lost his temper and pointed his gun at him and shouted, "One more word out of you and I'll shoot you." Sterling just said, "You haven't got the magazine in." And things like that. I think possibly the best incident was a Canadian officer named George Valentine, who was quite a light-hearted character, combined with three of us, the other two being two friends of mine from Oxford before the war, to acquire some yeast and ferment some stewed prunes and make what had been the first alcoholic drink we'd had for a very long time. And we fermented these prunes on a radiator for 6 weeks and then strained the result through a bit of sheet and invited everybody to a party. But of course, the trouble about homemade hooch is the flash point. 1 minute you are stone cold sober, and the next minute you are literally reeling between the walls of the room. This party became more and more boisterous, and eventually the Germans came into the camp. In a long line. We used to call them the goons because they walked left, right in a long line. And by this time, George Valentine, who was as high as anybody else, had escaped into the building in which the camp theatre was housed. And he was seen escaping, and the building was surrounded. The commandant came out in his leather coat he made a speech. All the prisoners were called together in front of the theatre, and he said he was going to make an example of whoever was responsible for all the noise and disturbance. We were all standing there watching, while in a little window immediately above the doorway, over the commandant's head, appeared the face of George Valentine. We could see him, but the guards couldn't. And he was obviously having difficulty in thinking because he'd had a great deal to drink. But he disappeared and shortly came back with a bucket full of water and tipped it straight over the commandant's head, at which we all dived for cover before the shooting started. I think that was one of the better occasions.
Was it common for guards to open fire on prisoners?
I only remember one such incident. An Indian officer was shot dead while playing tennicoit in Brunswick.
Tennicoit?
Yes, and he put his hand through the... there was a wire 5 meters from the barbed wire fence, which was called the tripwire, and the coit landed inside that, and he put his hand through the wire to pick it up, and the guard shot him dead.
How did the other POWs react?
Well, they were pretty angry, and senior officer told the German commandant that he wouldn't be responsible for the man's safety if he came in the camp, and he was moved shortly afterwards. I don't know what happened to him. I think one felt in general that one was safer in Germany than in Italy, that in Italy things might have happened accidentally through losing somebody losing his temper with a prisoner, the Latin temperament coming out. Whereas that if in Germany it was more drab, but one was safer. One felt that if one was killed, it would be as the result of a policy decision rather than accidentally.
Were there any further escape attempts?
From both Meeresgruber, one such attempt was made, and another attempt through the wire at Brunswick. The attempt from Meeresgruber was rather sad. One, they jumped from a train when being moved from one camp to another, and we heard that one was killed. He just dived headfirst from the moving train and collided his head first with one of those concrete posts alongside the line and was killed instantly. The other two were shot deliberately while attempting to escape, and their remains returned to the senior officer in the camp in a powdered milk tin, clim tin. On the other occasion, three people did get out of the Brunswick camp through the wire, which is a rather hazardous operation. In general, these two camps were pretty well guarded, and it was not an easy matter to get out. I think the conditions of a very large camp like Moosburg were far more appropriate to escape.
Did German attitudes towards you, behaviour towards you, change as the war wore on?
Towards the end, yes. They became increasingly apprehensive. I was walking back through the top of the attic in the block in Brunswick just after taking the news bulletin on the wireless one night, and I actually heard the sound of the barrage of the guns opening up as the Rhine was crossed 200 miles away. The attic acted as a sort of huge sounding board, and from that point on one could hear this barrage, and the Allies became, from being something one read about, with whom one had never been in contact apart from seeing the aircraft, one could actually hear them coming, and as they approached, the sounds became more and more definite, so that when we went out to be counted on roll call, this rumble was in the background, as it were, mocking the guards, and they became in their way as hypnotized by it, by the sound of the guns as we were, so they started to be a good deal more polite.
Had you transported the same radio from Mary's Trubow to Brunswick?
Yes.
How had you transported it?
We had several radios by this time. We had reserve radio teams in case we were captured, which were deposited and told to lie low, that they would be activated if one team was captured. We brought radios in various conditions. One of them, I think, is in the RAF Museum, was contained inside a gramophone. And the gramophone would still play, but there was, in fact, a radio in it. We had others. We took the other ones to bits and concealed them very carefully in different ways, and they were all sort of smuggled through. It was quite a large operation to get all the stuff through.
Were any radios ever discovered?
No. We found the files of the German camp security afterwards, after the end of the war, and there was quite a bit of minuting on the files as to whether or not, an argument as to whether or not we had a radio.
Was there ever any attempt to, as the end of the war approached, to try to undermine the morale of the guards by your superior knowledge of the situation?
I don't think that we needed to engage directly in that, though we could remind them, we could taunt them when the invasion happened, for instance. That was a tremendous day, and in fact, we learned of the invasion from the guards, because on that day we'd had some trouble. We'd had a search of the camp by the Gestapo, which was an exceptional thing, and we had to take additional security precautions. And on that particular day, the BBC announced it in the soon after it had happened, and the news leaked out, and people started taunting the guards a bit then, you know, sort of, you got it coming, and so forth. And I didn't, in fact, hear the full bulletin until 3:15 that day, because I was afraid to take the 3 o'clock bulletin, because I thought they might come in. So I took the BBC in German at 3:15, so that we could be out of the way and all hidden again by 3 o'clock. And my companion couldn't understand German, and he was trying to tune the set while bursting with excitement, because he couldn't understand a word, and I was saying, you know, it's come, etc., scribbling down the details. No, I don't think that we did taunt them very much. They came to understand that the war was coming to an end all too easily themselves. The bomb plot was, of course, another evening, July the 20th. I heard Hitler broadcast, because when we heard the news on an earlier bulletin that there had been this attempt, we took a chance and stayed on the air, not wondering what was going to happen. And so I was actually listening in to the we didn't normally listen to German stations, you see, but on this occasion we did. And I actually heard Hitler's broadcast, very incoherent, saying that this gang of criminals had attempted, that he was all right, he'd just got his arm slightly injured, and that they would be rooted out and dealt with ruthlessly, and so forth. That, of course, caused a great stir-up.
Did you listen to any other programs any channels apart from BBC?
No, we took the BBC in different languages in order to be free to in French or German or English, in order to be free, so that we didn't have to go on the air at the same time every day as a security precaution. And the German on this occasion, the German broadcasts on this particular occasion, we never took anything else and didn't bother to, really.
Can you tell me about the circumstances of your release?
Yes, it was a very dramatic day, really. The guns had got closer, and by December the 3rd, it was plain that the Allies were very close indeed. We had, in fact, done some preliminary tests on this transmitter in case it should be needed. And, of course, one was wondering very much how the transition from German control to friendly control could take place without our being killed in the process. And on the evening of the 3rd, which was a very fine, sunny evening, at about 6 o'clock, the Autobahn bridge just west of the camp went up with a roar. And we all looked out from the windows at the top of the block, and we could see movements of tank trails, dust on the high ground the other side. It was clear that they had blown the bridges, and that all west of that bridge had been abandoned by the German army, which was very encouraging. But then, of course, yesterday, the next day, absolutely nothing happened. We didn't know what to make of it. There were a few bursts of machine gun fire, but we saw no troops at all. And it was a complete anticlimax. And we thought we'd been bypassed and left in a pocket of German resistance or something. We didn't know. But the day following, the six of us who ran the wireless and who lived in one room together, when we got up, the chap who acted as our chef and did the cooking announced that we'd just got enough food left. We'd been on very short rations for a very long time, and the railway system was disrupted, and conditions had got down to a fairly low level in the camp as regards food. He said he'd got just enough food for one more meal, and we could either have three small meals or one large one. And so we all voted to have one large breakfast. And this was prepared, and we were just sitting down to eat it. We never actually got a mouthful, because there was a roar of cheering in the camp. And we rushed outside, and there was already a crowd of several hundred inside the camp gate. And I couldn't see. I went up with a chap who'd been a press photographer, a man named Click Vanderson. We went up into the roof of the block beside the gate, and he'd got a camera and film, which he'd been hiding for this occasion, and he was hastily loading the film into the camera while I was knocking the tiles out of the roof to get a view. And we saw down the track leading up to the camp an American armored car piled high with foreign workers waving and cheering, led by an American Jeep with a half-inch machine gun mounted on it. And they came slowly up this track to the camp. There was a sudden hush, so quiet that I could hear the ratchet of the brake on the Jeep. And the sergeant stood up in the thing and said, "How do you get into this place?" About 1,000 people shouted out, "Never mind how you get in, we want to get out." And they then arrived, the 150th U.S. Cavalry, it was. They went round, took their tanks round, bulldozing the barbed wire fence out of existence. They poured food into us, they took us out and gave us meals in their messes. They couldn't have been better. So I can say that to anybody who's ever seen a Wild West film with the American cavalry arriving at the last minute, that I was rescued by the 150 U.S. Cavalry. A great occasion.
Did they make arrangements immediately for you to be got back?
We had to wait a week, which was a very hard time to wait. We combed the surrounding countryside for food. And as I said, the Americans gave us of what they had and were very good to us. But then we were picked up by air on the 12th and flown to England via Brussels in a long stream of Dakotas. I think that Indian officer who was killed, that incident saved a lot of lives, because the Germans put most of the officer prisoners in camps near us on the road and marched them east at this point. But because of this incident, a German Foreign Office official had been sent down to the camp to see what the commandant was doing and to supervise our relations with the German army because of this incident. And this officer was still there, and he overruled the commandant when the orders came to put us on the road, and he said, no, leave them here. And for that reason, we were one of the few camps which were not put on the road. And I think we probably owe our lives to that, because a lot of prisoners were shot up by mistake when on the road.
Did you have any debriefing session once you got back to Britain?
Not a full debriefing. We all had to fill in a long form giving an account of anything we knew that was of intelligence importance or relevance.
Had you managed to get such information yourself? Any useful information?
Well, my report concerned largely the radio business that I had been engaged in, and we had had a case of a man planted in the camp who was subsequently tried and executed, a renegade, and I reported what I knew of that man. Otherwise, it was largely a question of particulars of where one had been and what one had seen and who had been killed and any next of kin type information that was appropriate.
Who exactly was this renegade? A British person, you mean?
Yes. I can't quite remember his name. I have a feeling it was some name like Byrne. But it happened when, in the period after the bombing of the camp, when the electricity supply was cut off, and we were constructing the hand generator, the Germans, though we already knew, because of course being engaged in this clandestine radio, we were kept informed of what risks there were as the senior officers in the camp understood them, and we knew that there was a risk. But this man had had dealings with the Germans, legitimate dealings, and they had agreed to run an electricity wire into to a point in the camp so that an open air cafe could take place with a light in the evening, as a sort of morale boosting exercise, or so it was presented. So we had the temptation that there was electric power in the camp in the evening, and the question was whether we dare disclose ourselves so as to use it, and we did in fact take a bullet in there, but in the circumstances that followed, it became clear that there had been a leakage, which could only have been attributed to this chap, and that it had been an attempt to find out whether there was a wireless or not. We didn't get caught, but he was the camp's suspicions were confirmed, and the senior officer said to the Germans that they'd better remove him as he couldn't be responsible for his safety. But I think he was caught up with after the war.
The Germans did remove him, did they?
They did.
Did your POW experience as a whole leave any long-term effects with you?
No, I don't think so. There were various short-term effects. I mean, one's weight went from 9 stone to about 14 stone in a matter of a few weeks. But my father was a doctor, and so I followed a fairly careful diet for the first few months afterwards and recovered physically. I think it taught one to, of course, improvisation is the middle name of every prisoner of war, the turning of whatever you happen to be looking at into something else, to make use of the tiles off the wall to as lithograph stone for printing a map, or to turn a pair of shoes into a pair of Italian-looking sandals, so on. You're constantly thinking in these terms, and one tended afterwards to wonder sort of why anybody was so foolish as to give a pound note for a perfectly good hat, and what use is a bit of paper? This kind of feeling one had, and in one's trust of individuals, I think that one came to look at people to see whether they were ultimately trustworthy, whether you really felt you could count on them in a corner. The superficial pleasantries of life ceased to have much importance. We got to know each other very well, of course, to the point that we didn't need to talk very much to each other. We knew it all. One had only got to say one word to start a well-known train of thought. And when one got back, I remember thinking on Guildford Station the night I got back, how fast everybody was walking. We'd been used to walking very slowly. But all these things sort of gradually faded out. And having been physically fit throughout most of it, I had no long-term things. It was an interesting and in many respects useful experience.
Did it change your attitude to either the Italians or Germans?
For a long time, I disliked the sound of the Italian language, and although I could speak it, I had no inclination to do so. On the other hand, having spoken German from before the war, I felt I felt no such inhibition in their case. And of course, there had been that incident I told you about the apples, which showed me that the links between peoples are not necessarily extinguished by the acts of government. One rather curious fact about POW life I discovered quite by accident after the war. There had in the camp in Italy been an officer named Tony Maxton Graham, and he had contributed enormously to the morale of the camp by writing plays, producing musicals, and developing an enormous talent as an impresario, which was really the backbone of our morale. I met his daughter by accidentally after the war. She was working for an American magazine, and I asked her whether she was related, and discovered that she was his daughter. I said to her, I'm very glad to meet you, because we owe an enormous debt to your father for what he did in the camp. I mean, without his inspiration, we would not have come through it so relatively unscathed. And she said, he's never spoken a word about it. I don't know what you're talking about. And I then told her that what her father had done in the camp. He'd come home and resumed his family life and never said one word about what he'd done.